Welcome to Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria, with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
A very warm welcome to our Care in Action podcast. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Maciej Popowski, the Director General of ECHO, the European Commission's Department for Humanitarian Aid and Civil Protection. With a long career in EU external action, he now leads one of the world's largest humanitarian operations, coordinating Europe's response to crises, from conflict and displacement to climate-driven disasters, while defending the humanitarian principles of neutrality, impartiality, and independence. ECHO is a key partner to CARE and also to CARE Austria, and we always work with a strong focus on women and girls. So, Director General Popowski, thank you for joining us in this podcast. And I would like to jump right into the topic. If you look at the humanitarian landscape today, so what are the top priorities for DG ECHO? And I mean both from the political and also from the operational side.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me. We are faced with numerous challenges, obviously, but given the fact that the humanitarian setup, as we know it, is under a lot of pressure, it is key for us to remain a leading, a predictable, and a principled donor. And what it means in practice is that we want our partners to be able to rely on us, because there is so much volatility. There have been huge funding cuts in the recent years. By the way, not only in the United States.
That's true.
Many European donors have reduced their budget for good reasons, but it has increased the pressure on humanitarian operators, and the needs only keep increasing. It's close to 300 million people in need of humanitarian aid, and the numbers just keeps growing. What we are really proud of is that we are also a predictable donor. Our budget remains stable, not least due to stable support from the European Parliament and the member states, which gives partners like CARE and many others this breathing space. You know exactly what you're going to, I mean, how much we can support you in a given year. And again, in a volatile world, predictability has become a real virtue. And last but not least, we are a principled donor. So we stick to the humanitarian principles of neutrality, independence, humanity, impartiality. We keep politics at bay, because politics is never far away. I mean, we also operate in highly politicized contexts, but our interventions are always needs-based. We are not taking sides. We don't put unnecessary conditions to our partners. Of course, and I guess we'll discuss it a bit later, that our aid also comes with some strings attached, but it has to do with accountability, with financial management, good financial management. Mm-hmm. It's not politics. And that's very important for us, that again, everybody can count on EU's continued principled support. And as we are now drafting a major policy paper, a communication, as we call it in our parlance, on humanitarian aid that will be adopted by the European Commission at the end of May, that will be a great opportunity for us to restate those principles again and to explain how we see our role as a major donor of humanitarian aid.
Of a principled humanitarian aid, I think it is not exaggerated that the European Union, with the dismantling of USAID, has the leading role at the moment in the world. And it is for us highly important, and we really appreciate that in your initial statement, you said that you are going to be and you want to be a reliable partner. So you mentioned it already. We talk about 300 million people. As we speak, the number is increasing due to many crises. OCHA, the UN coordination institution, talks for 2026 about 239 million people. But no matter which number you take, the needs are increasing. The resources are more and more limited, not only in the US. So is it difficult for you in your position to decide where to focus? And how is it balanceable, this discrepancy between protracted crises like we see them, especially in the Middle East, but also in other places, and the sudden onset emergencies like earthquake, flooding, you name it? How do you do that?
It's a balancing act, but it's not impossible. And that is one of my major tasks and challenges, to keep that overall balance. There is this term that we use very often, forgotten crisis, and I tend to contradict it in the sense that from our point of view, there is no forgotten crisis. So we always remain engaged until we're no longer necessary. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen too often. You could say that the ultimate dream of every humanitarian operator is to make him or herself redundant. But again, it doesn't
happen. That's not what we see.
and by the way, most of the crises, in particular the man-made crises, so political or security-related crises, tend to turn into protracted ones. And there are very few crises that have been contained or that have come to a definitive end. I mean, there are some examples. You may remember the conflict in Aceh in Indonesia, but there's not too many examples. So first of all, we keep the right geographical balance. So even though the war in Ukraine is very close and it's of vital importance to Europe, and Ukraine remains one of our top priorities, when you look at the figures, our level of engagement, let's say the top 5-6 crises are geographically spread. So it's Ukraine. Mm-hmm. I mean, the top crisis in terms of ECOWAS engagement, financial, political, you name it, advocacy-wise. Ukraine, Sudan, Gaza and West Bank, Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, and I would say Venezuela. So
Venezuela, what about Myanmar?
As well.
Yeah.
As well. I mean, we
but really globally spread. That's
yeah. We mainly operate in Bangladesh because of the concentrated presence of Rohingyas in Cox's Bazar. We never lose sight of a crisis. You know, when I arrived in my current job in March 2023, and that was exactly when the current phase of the civil war in Sudan, I would say, deteriorated. So it was in a way a formative experience with the takeover by RSF of Khartoum, with direct threats to our staff, and later on, because of Gaza, for instance, or certain events in Afghanistan, of course, the ongoing war in Ukraine, somehow people stopped talking about Sudan. And yet it remains the biggest crisis in terms of impact on people and the whole region. That's why we co-hosted a ministerial meeting on Sudan in Berlin only 10 days ago, also to send a strong political signal of our continued and continuous engagement. Budgeting is never easy. Our budget is significant, with the usual top-ups every year. We are at roughly 2.5 billion euro, which is much less than US budget before the foreign aid review. So it's clear that we are not going to stop the gap. Neither do we want to stop the gap, because everybody should take his or her own share of responsibility for the humanitarian course. But we are using our budget wisely. I mean, the whole programming, which is pretty uncomplicated compared to development aid, as we
That's
know,
true.
Is pretty decentralized. So we always ask our field offices for input. Of course, we have to do the necessary arbitration at headquarters level, but usually we really try to follow the lead of the people who know what's happening. And we have a global network of ECHO field offices, 45 country offices, 5 regional offices, with dedicated and extremely experienced people who can lead the process. So I think we are doing quite fine. Of course, there is never enough. I mean, we are well served by the European Parliament and the member states. It's never enough, but we can certainly ensure continuity of our engagement, and we can also intervene in case of a sudden emergency or a sudden deterioration, which was the case, for instance, a year ago, where a lot of agencies got cut off. And they had real issues running out of liquidity, and there was a risk of them losing access to certain services, humanitarian flights, etc. And they intervened and managed to keep our partners afloat.
I'm representing CARE at the UN Interagency Standing Committee, and I want to share with you that at the moment the whole system really is relying very much also on the European Union, without having the idea that this will close a gap that the US has left. This is impossible, but still everybody turns now to the European Union even more than before. Is that your impression as well?
It is. Again, there are certain limitations, and we cannot do everything. We also have to set priorities. It's never easy. By the way, I mean, the US are now returning with they've resumed funding for OCHA on certain conditions. We will not do the same. So we are impartial, and our interventions are based on real needs of the people on the ground. But we welcome the fact that there is more money. The more money is available, whether it's for OCHA
to the system
or other agencies, because this is the latest development of the end of last week that the U.S. Have concluded the memorandum of understanding with a number of agencies, which we welcome very much. We will continue doing things our way on our own terms. And we also discussed it with OCHA at several occasions. But indeed, I get this feedback from a lot of agencies. And I see them regularly in the field, in Brussels, in New York, in Geneva. And they know they can count on us.
Now, which is really something that is very precious to us. And we have talked a lot about the NGO partners that you also have. Can you summarize a bit, what is the specific added value that you see when DG ECHO partners with NGOs like CARE or CARE Austria? What is the specific benefit that you see?
Our NGO partners are usually well embedded in the local context. So they have their own network. Some of you are specialized in a certain area of expertise, which is valuable. And of course, we use both the UN agencies, by the way, and international and European NGOs as the entry point for engagement with local partners. You know, we are attached to this concept of the principle of localization that was highlighted or identified in the Grand Bargain 10 years ago. However, we have our own legal limitations, and we are not able to fund local NGOs ourselves. So we always go through other partners, whether it's NGO partners like CARE or UN agencies. But it's good to have a wider pool of partners rather than just one or two. And we are now reviewing the rules. Reviewing the rules. You know that every NGO partners has to go through a so-called certification process.
Yes, I know it well.
We are preparing for the next 7 years budget. We are also going to renew the certificates of most of our partners, but there will be no major changes. So,
yeah.
Even under the next budget, as of 2028, the rules will remain the same. And this is another message of reassurance. We made it very explicit in the Commission proposal for the next 7 years budget, that we are not going to reopen the 1996 humanitarian aid regulation.
Mm-hmm.
It has served us well, and will not be reopened. So, you know, same rules, same predictability, which I think is something that the partners value very much.
Mm-hmm. So this leads us directly to our next topic, which is the administrative complexity of European and also to a certain extent of ECHO funding. And I want to be very clear, I'm not complaining about it. We have been full certified ECHO partners for many years in Austria. We're the biggest partner of ECHO in Austria. We are very proud about that. But are you thinking, or how are you working to simplify some of the procedures, while it is very clear that we have to have strong accountability measures in place, because in the end, we are talking about European tax money. So I want to be very clear, we fully understand it, but on the other side, it takes away a big part of our capacity to fulfill all the things that we have to present to ECHO in order to stay a partner of choice in the future. Do you see any changes there, or?
Yeah, change is happening as we speak. I mean, first of all, the rules are there for a reason. As you said, they mainly concern accountability. We didn't invent them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are quite heavy reporting requirements. We have to fulfill accommodate a lot of requests by the European Court of Auditors, by the Budgets Control Committee of the European Parliament. Fair enough, because we are talking
about
public funding.
Yeah.
But what we decided to do, and this is relatively recent, so the second half of last year, I launched a simplification process in DG ECHO. So we are looking at all the rules that are not necessary. For instance, we are now making progress on single forms for partners to handle. We would like to reduce the number of contracts that we are signing with different entities.
Mm-hmm.
We are also making progress, which is very much in line with the humanitarian reset, to simplify and streamline our procurement, and that we do it more in a more coordinated way,
mm-hmm.
and that we do it on the spot, that we do more joint procurement whenever we can. So hopefully that would make life easier. We're also trying to make our own life easier. For instance, we have a lot of information products that are probably no longer justified, because there's access to so much information. And so whatever we can do to make things easier, we will. But of course, the accountability requirements will not change.
No, that's very obvious and clear to me. And we have mentioned now the role of the UN system, the role of NGOs, and we mentioned briefly also the role of local actors, which is becoming increasingly important, I would say. And we, as CARE International, we work super close together with local NGOs and local actors. What about the risk appetite for ECHO when it comes to working closely with local actors? Of course, there are accountability mechanisms that also apply to them, but this is maybe the biggest burden in practical work for local organizations. What is your take on that?
As I mentioned, we are not going to reopen our rule book. And the humanitarian aid regulation is rather prescriptive. So we are only allowed to work directly with UN agencies, international and European NGOs. I think it was about 2 years ago, I decided to analyze it again with the team, and we concluded that we would not do that. Because if we were to reopen the regulation just for that, probably, I mean, there was a real risk that we would lose a lot of flexibility that we have otherwise. Yeah. So we decided not to do that. On the other hand, we decided, and that was already a decision taken by Commissioner Labib, to increase our localization spending target. So to go gradually to 25% of our budget as of 2027. And we are getting there slowly, meaning more outreach, more encouragement to certified partners and UN agencies to engage with local NGOs. They also have very good access, direct access to ECHO offices. I mean, our people are really well connected, well integrated. So I travel quite a lot and I spend time with ECHO offices. And every time I am in the field, I meet the local organizations, even in remote, let's say more challenging places like Afghanistan or, I don't know, Burkina Faso. So we always listen to them. There are certain things we cannot change. But we decided to adopt this target to create a little bit of pressure on ourselves, because it's a commitment, so we have to have to get there, and on the partners, you know, to encourage them to share more, to be more forthcoming, more accommodating with regard to local partners.
Now, this is really interesting, I'm sure, also for our listeners to hear. And everybody who follows our podcast knows that CARE and CARE International are deeply committed and working closely with local partners and local NGOs. I would like to move our conversation now a bit from to the regional focus of MENA, which is the Middle East and North African region, because CARE Austria in particular, and this podcast is hosted by CARE Austria, we are big partners of ECHO in this special region. So would you say from your experience and where you see it, that MENA is maybe most in the focus now also out in the public?
Well, there is certainly more interest because of the latest developments. I mean, not least the war, the Gulf, and its regional and global impact. But otherwise, it's very close to home. So we spend a lot of time and energy dealing with Gaza, West Bank, Syria, Yemen. We are present there. By the way, we never left Syria. So ECHO has been there throughout the since the beginning of the civil war. Now we are fully present on the ground with a fully fledged office in Damascus. And we also cooperate with CARE Austria in Syria, looking in particular at the displaced people. And focusing on the north of the country, right? Gaza is another good example where we funded a CARE Austria project, which is mainly to provide shelter, wash and hygiene assistance. There, the situation is pretty grim, as we know, and we are really glad that some partners are still able to operate in that difficult, difficult environment. So this is so both Syria and Gaza and West Bank, because we never forget about the West Bank, remain a top priority. So our budget for Gaza and West Bank this year is already at 125 million. Euros and likely to grow. In Syria, we are at around 160.
And again, what we see and the examples that you shared, these would summarize in many cases under Nexus projects. That means that there is an overlap of humanitarian assistance and long-term aid that has to be provided. So in this particular case, would you say that in MENA, Nexus becomes more relevant again?
Well, Nexus is relevant everywhere, but it's not happening everywhere. I wouldn't equal Nexus with an overlap. It's mm-hmm. You see it as a transition mechanism. It's not easy, of course, but it has worked in Syria, in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. We hope it will work in Sudan. Syria is a good example also because this is... I went to Syria for the first time in 2024, so before the fall of the regime. And at that time, it was politically impossible to work with the authorities, so we had to work around that. And we, both DG ECHO, but also other parts of the house at that time, the so-called DG NIR that was in charge of the MENA countries, now it's DG MENA, we started funding early recovery projects. And mm-hmm. I visited some of them. In the Hama province, for instance, you know, bakeries, water purification stations, irrigation systems, repaired or restored with EU funding. And this is still very far away from any large-scale reconstruction, but something mm-hmm. that could be scaled up.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the type of intervention that we are ready to support. The same in Afghanistan or in Sudan now. So I hope we'll see more of it. And by the way, as I mentioned, the communication, the upcoming communication that will focus on three mm-hmm. main pillars. One is international humanitarian law, compliance and advocacy. Second is... logistics and supply chain, and the third is fragility, meaning the need and so we also going to propose an integrated approach to fragility, which is in essence about Nexus, because the humanitarian interventions in fragile states are needed, are timely, but should be rather short-lived. Should be, because it's never
in theory, yes.
But we should be able to join forces with others, in particular if the political conditions are in place, to resume, let's say, more traditional kind of development cooperation. And if it's not the case, then again, we have to be creative, because if the humanitarians are left alone, our impact on or our ability to produce change is quite limited.
Yes, absolutely. And you're right, I oversimplified my Nexus explication. On the other hand, some of our listeners are not experts in humanitarian mm-hmm. aid. Mm-hmm. And it is really about sparking income generating possibilities and not keeping people on the long run under humanitarian assistance, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. This is what it is about. Let us touch briefly also on a livelihood, climate change, impact of climate change. This is also a topic, of course, in MENA, but not only. How is this integrated and how is anticipatory action integrated in our cooperation? Could you frame that from the side of ECHO, from your perspective?
Well, the impact of climate change is enormous, whether it's in Bangladesh or mm-hmm. in Sudan or in Sahel countries or in Afghanistan. That's why, indeed, we are scaling up anticipatory action, mm-hmm. both helping build capacity of local responders, civil protection authorities, rescue workers, or local communities in general. We can also, or we are providing funding for necessary investment at community level, so that the impact of a disaster when it occurs is mitigated. Actually, we had a discussion in the house with I have a climate change advisor, and there was a whole team with whom we discussed the matter in more general terms. And they rightly brought up the example of the Rohingyas. Mm-hmm. I remember my visit to the camps in June 2023, where we could see with our own eyes the rather positive effects of our modest, relatively, in relative terms, investment. For instance, at some point, the people they were desperate and they had no access to fuel. So they basically cut all the trees in the whole the whole area. So these are 21 camps located on hills. And these hills are vulnerable to climate shocks, so landslides, heavy rain, rainfalls, etc. And then we provided funding, not only us, but other donors as well, for UNHCR and IOM to buy cooking oil and fuel or gas, LNG gas. And it stopped. And then a program of reforestation was launched. And when I was there, all the hills were green.
Which is really key because landslides are
solidifies,
dangerous.
Solidifies the soil. Mm-hmm. And so that's one example of many what you can do with relatively modest means to prevent, not to prevent certain disasters from happening.
Mitigate.
It's not possible, but to mitigate the impact, yes.
Yeah. And do you think that anticipatory action, is it more difficult to fund than other things in your work portfolio?
Sometimes it may be because you don't see the results immediately.
Mm-hmm.
No, when you provide food aid, you just give cash handouts to people and they go and buy food. You can measure that easily. In case of anticipatory action, you have to wait for the next rainy season or the next earthquake to strike, and then you can see whether it has worked or not. But we also have examples within Europe that has to do with my other portfolio, another head, which is civil protection, that we've invested a lot in the management of forests, in the prevention of floods and wildfires. They still happen, but with the right kind of approach and the right kind of investment, the impact can be mitigated.
Mm-hmm. Which is really key also in Austria at the moment. We have huge forest, parts of our forest burning because it's so dry. This is not only true to Austria, this is for all whole Central Europe. So also in our setting, we have to invest into anticipatory action. Before we come to an end, so in all the meetings that I participate, digitalization is really something that we are heavily discussing, and depending on where you sit, some think this might help us, might be a game changer in the future also to be more efficient, to save more. At the same time, we have the whole data protection issue that is especially from a European side something that we always bring to the table. So what is your view on that? And is ECHO encouraging its partners to make use of digital tools in order to be more efficient? And what is your personal view on that?
No, absolutely. We are encouraging our partners. One example is data collection. You know, everybody needs data.
Yeah.
And for both accountability and for programming. We had a couple of serious cases recently of aid diversion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with those local gatekeepers demanding kickbacks or bribes, etc., or deciding on whom the aid would go to. That was the case in Ethiopia and in Somalia. It also concerned other donors, US in the first place. And when I went on a verification mission myself with WFP more than a year ago, and we went to a couple of places in northern Ethiopia, and you could see that because of a new approach to data collection, basically the whole system of providing aid, cash aid in particular, moved from community to household level, because you could identify people, but for that you need a database with with personal data, you know, fingerprints, names, telephone numbers. It has to be properly protected and managed. Mm-hmm. But it's a great mitigating measure.
Yeah, that's a good example that we also have to make sure together that the cash voucher or whatever is provided really reaches the person that it is dedicated to, right?
Yes.
And this could help
even
us.
In remote places, for instance, in, mm-hmm. in Baidoa in Somalia. Mm-hmm. I spent 2 days there 2 years ago and we went to cash distribution points operated by, I think it was WFP again. You know, these days, you know, even poor people in remote places, everybody has a mobile phone.
Yes, and has
to
have
one. First of all, it's a great way of identifying a beneficiary, and you can work with digital transfers.
Absolutely. Even for cash transfers, it's the only way in many places.
And it works. Right? I saw a lot of people coming from camps for internally displaced people in that part of Somalia coming to those cash distribution points with the mobile phones. They were being registered by the teams and they got their installments. It was all digital without any paper trace. Basically watertight.
Which is really key. And as you said twice, the data has to be protected in any way. But if this is the case, then this is really a good, powerful tool where we all could benefit from. So I would like to finish our conversation where we started it. Right in the beginning, you said the forgotten crisis, there are no forgotten crises. You might know or you might not know that CARE International, under the lead of CARE Austria and CARE Germany, has released this year the 10th edition of the so-called Forgotten Crisis Report. And it measures the connection between media appearance and funding from private persons, but also from institutional funding that goes to the high number of humanitarian crises that we see. And it gets a lot of attention. Of course, the approach that we take is different than the approach that the EU is taking on that. But don't you think there is a slight connection between presence in the media, how people, civil society, is informed about a crisis like Sudan or not informed, and about the funding that is dedicated then to the crisis?
Well, it is. I mean, when I say that there is no such a thing as a forgotten crisis, from our point of view, is that for us the media perception and the public perception is not the criteria.
Yeah, I know that you have different criteria. Yeah.
So we are still operating in the Sahrawi camps in Africa, or we are still present in Mauritania and other places that are less obvious, maybe less visible these days. But of course, it's easier to mobilize additional funding for a very visible, high impact crisis like Sudan. Or organize, but the attention is shifting.
Of course.
Let's say it has less impact on public donor. I mean, on donors. I mean, member states donors, institutional donors. Probably it has impact on charities.
Yeah, and also on civil society engagement.
Yes.
Right.
Indeed.
This is not to underestimate. No. And I know that the EU has different criteria for it, but still, I think it is encouraging for me as a humanitarian to hear you say that there are no forgotten crises for you because you take care of also not so obvious countries like Mauritania or the West Sahara or what you mentioned.
We do. We just sometimes we have to reduce our presence or we phase out certain commitments, certain programs, because we have to make choices too.
Of course.
But it never happens abruptly. There is no disruption. We give everybody an early warning. We prepare our exit if it happens in a very orderly way.
So, dear Mr. Popovsky, the Director General of ECHO, our guest today, I always try to end on a positive tone, even if the topic is that serious, that our topic today. So is there any key message that you would like to share to close our conversation?
I hope that the next 7 years budget of the EU, which is a hotly debated topic these days, and our leaders had just a discussion on that last week at the gathering in Cyprus, will confirm our leading role as a humanitarian donor. And in our proposal to the Council, we suggested that the humanitarian aid be endowed with at least 25 billion euros for 7 years, which would mean a significant increase of about 40%. This still needs to be confirmed. This whole discussion about figures and sources of funding, you know, the own resources, the revenue of the European Union is yet to happen. But so far, I have heard no dissenting voices. On the contrary, the Parliament is already quite outspoken about the need to have a certain floor, a minimum allocation for humanitarian aid, but certainly no ceiling, given the unpredictability of the world we live in.
This is totally encouraging, not only for me as the leader of Care Austria, but firsthand for the people that are struggling on a daily basis and are in dire need of humanitarian aid. So I really appreciate that you took the time, Director General Popovsky of ECHO, to have this conversation. I hope that our appreciated listeners also enjoyed this important conversation. And yeah, it's good to be European. Let me end like that. And I hope that we all see each other and hear each other next week for another episode of Care in Action. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. This was Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For more information about Care and our projects, visit care.at. There you'll also find out how you can support our work. This podcast is made possible with the generous support of CC Real. Thank you for your commitment, which enables this series of conversations. See you next time.